The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium.
Hello, Stephanomics here, the podcast that brings you the global economy. And we're visiting some of the forgotten corners of the periodic table these days.
And iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium.
As the world struggles to get its hands on the critical minerals we'll need to power electric car batteries and all those other green machines. Good news for green tech companies, maybe. But will it also spell new riches for the countries that currently have these much sought-after materials? Historians would say, don't bet on it. There's a long and deeply depressing tradition of commodity-rich economies failing to benefit from their natural wealth. With a handful of notable exceptions, such countries all too often end up worse off than neighbours that weren't blessed with all those natural assets in the first place. Could this time finally be different? I'm going to debate that in a few minutes with Bloomberg commodity reporter and author Jack Farchi and World Bank senior economist Jim Cust. But first, Bloomberg's Indonesia economy reporter Claire Zhao and metals and mining reporter Annie Lee have an encouraging story to tell you from Indonesia. The reporting was done by both of them, but it's Claire's voice you'll hear doing the narration.
When you think of elements like nickel and aluminum, they're probably just boxes on the periodic table. But these minerals are essential components that go into making batteries for electric vehicles. This is a $400 billion industry, and no one knows this better than Indonesia. Made up of over 17,000 islands and lush rainforests, Indonesia sits atop an abundant reserve of native metal. Copper, gold, and nickel, the raw material used in EV batteries. For decades, Indonesia has been content with digging up the minerals and sending them to places like China, where skilled workers and factories turn them into higher value products, like batteries or electric cars. But now, the biggest economy in Southeast Asia has other ideas. Why should Indonesia stop at exporting raw ore when it can export the batteries that are made from them, and even the cars powered by those batteries?
Indonesia's ban on raw bauxite exports began over the weekend. The ban is meant to encourage more investment into higher value-added activities onshore.
The bottom line, if you want our minerals, you have to process them here. For President Joko Widodo, Indonesia's natural wealth is the key for it to become a high-income country.
Industrial downstreaming is very important. We will leap forward if downstreaming is successful. To achieve the Golden Indonesia of 2045, smart execution is needed.
It's estimated to add more than $700 billion to the economy and create nearly 10 million jobs. To push this strategy forward, Indonesia uses a carrot-and-stick approach. On one hand, it's clamped down on exports of some raw mineral ores. On the other, it's offered tax breaks and incentives, luring companies to build smelters and battery plants within its borders. And it's already working.
But is it good to go?
To get a better idea of how the carrot and stick approach materialized, I spoke with Muhammad Faiz Nagusa, ASEAN economist at Bank of America.
We saw about $11 billion of FDI being realized into that sector.
By that sector, he means nickel downstreaming.
But that is just that sector. Beyond that, we're also seeing more investments likely coming into other smelters, copper smelters, for example, as well as battery-grade nickel, and even producing EV batteries themselves. So the investment inflows into Indonesia is getting beefed up because of this success in downstreaming.
Nowhere is that boom more apparent than in Morowali. It's a nickel-rich district in Indonesia's Sulawesi Island, east of Borneo. Once a quiet fishing town, it now houses the bustling Morowali Industrial Park, which just celebrated its 10-year anniversary this month. Trucks are busy transporting ore from mines to smelters, buses full of workers shuttling across the area. The park even has its own private airport and port facilities. Nowadays, it employs more than 80,000 Indonesian and Chinese workers here. For the first 5 months this year, this park has already registered $22 billion of investment. That's compared with a record of $21 billion for the whole 2022.
To be clear, such success is quite rare. Indonesia holds the world's largest deposit of nickel, a mineral in short supply. The same goes for Botswana when it comes to diamonds. The global diamond manufacturer De Beers relies on Botswana's mines. Leveraging that, the Botswana government struck a deal that set aside a portion of rough diamonds to local cutting and polishing companies. Historically, polishing usually happened in places like Antwerp, Belgium.
Other countries, though, face more basic challenges.
And here it's important to maybe use the example of the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Rohitesh Dhawan, head of the International Council on Mining and Minerals.
In DRC, a decision was taken to process copper concentrate in the DRC itself. But that had to be delayed because copper producers simply didn't have enough electricity in order to be able to process the copper. So you can't do copper smelting without electricity, and the DRC was not producing enough of the electricity in order to keep that plant going. And so you might think, why don't companies set up more processing plants? Well, actually, if you don't have enough of the energy you need, and increasingly low carbon and low cost energy you need, it's very difficult to process.
This success doesn't come free either. For one, there's the environmental price. Given the tons of waste generated and the coal burnt to provide electricity for factories. My colleague Annie Lee visited a residential building outside of the Indonesian park, where she met Ricky Ardiansyah. Ricky rents rooms to Indonesian workers and owns a construction business.
Airnya itu hitam.
Oh, the water, the rain yeah. Drop is color is black.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yang jatuh dari sini
hitam.
Oh, because maybe the air pollute the dust.
I think gas and in air maybe and then the dust here.
Ricky told us when it rains, the raindrops turn black from the dust in the air. Just outside this building, there's a river that runs across the neighborhood. It looks like a canal of tomato soup. Now, President Jokowi also wants to apply the same strategy, not only to other metals, but into agriculture, farming, and fisheries. Every sector that Indonesia has clout, but not dominance. With the 2024 elections looming, it raises questions. Will his successor repeat the same trick? Here's economist Nagusa again.
The success is so evident that I think most investors assume that it will be unlikely for any future governments to say, you know, we need to revert this policy. The success in terms of exports and the investments are very visible. So the assumption is that there will be pretty much a good degree of policy continuity on this downstreaming. So if something were to change, I think that will come as a negative and nasty surprise for investors.
Whatever the outcome, other countries will be closely watching. If they want a bigger role in the supply chain, their minerals may be their fastest way to get there. In Jakarta, Claire Yao for Bloomberg News.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
So I want to step back to consider now how this has gone in the past and whether there's any prospect for countries elsewhere in the world, especially Africa, to benefit from the rush to acquire the minerals that will be needed to wean the planet off fossil fuels. And to help us do that, I'm joined by Jim Cust, senior economist in the Africa Department at the World Bank, who's written extensively on this subject, and Bloomberg's energy and commodities reporter Jack Farchi, who co-authored with Javier Blas The World for Sale, which is a cracking book on global commodity trading. Jim Cust, Jack, thank you very much for this. Jim, let me start with you. Let's go back in time first and think, what's the traditional story of a commodity boom for developing country? Before we get on to how this time might be different, what has traditionally been the problem for developing countries looking to get full advantage from these kind of booms?
Sure. Many countries have found it very challenging to move from being a major resource-dependent economy, so whether that's mining or in other cases it's been oil and gas, and turn that below-ground wealth into above-ground prosperity. So we've all heard of the resource curse, and this is sort of the classical case of countries that have commodity booms followed by busts, and if they haven't saved and invested enough of their revenues, then the bust can hit them even harder than the boom in the first place. And so countries have got into these kind of cyclical challenges that ultimately has added up to many of them stagnating and growing a lot slower than their neighbors that didn't have the resources. And that's what economists think of as the resource curse, that you end up growing slower than you might have done otherwise.
It's always striking how few there are, but there are a few countries that have managed to get around this.
Yeah, absolutely. So the resource curse is certainly not universal. So we can think of countries like Chile and Indonesia, Australia, of course. But in Africa, countries like Botswana have done very well from their resources and have really succeeded in taking something that is a sort of primary commodity dependence and then turning those revenues into something you can invest in the rest of the economy and have done well out of it.
What would you advise countries who are trying to repeat the Botswana example, or is it just impossible?
It's not impossible. So the way that we think about it is it's like a chain of decisions, and the chain of decisions is only as strong as the weakest link. So there are many places where the chain of decisions can go wrong, but governments have to make a series of decisions. So everything from negotiating a good deal in the first place with the private sector companies that you're typically working with, all the way through to making sure you get those revenues and then you use those revenues effectively, that you avoid corruption and you avoid mismanagement and the boom-bust price cycle and so on. So there's a series of decisions, and at each step in that decision chain, there are examples from countries like Botswana that you can emulate. And actually, Botswana has just been in the news very recently because they've renegotiated their deal with De Beers, and they have a reputation for negotiating a very tough deal when they work with the private sector.
And we actually heard a little bit about De Beers in the earlier piece. So, Jack, when you think about the move to net zero. Of course, lots of people wonder whether we really make the move to net zero, but there's certainly a massive rush for the materials that we need to build all of those batteries for electric cars and generally sort of power the transition away from carbon. What does that mean in practical terms? What kind of commodities are we talking about and where are they currently?
I think the big one where markets are being totally transformed as a result of even the steps that we're taking at the moment towards net zero, even if together they're not enough necessarily to get us to net zero by 2050. But the big ones where markets are being totally transformed is the commodities that go into batteries for electric vehicles. And the key ones are things like lithium, nickel, cobalt, perhaps to a slightly lesser extent, manganese, graphite, and then things like copper and aluminium that are used in electrical wiring and therefore important both for the batteries, but also the power cables, the charging stations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Some of those markets are already quite large and well established. So things like manganese and nickel already have a large use in the steel sector. They're used as alloys in things like stainless steel and other steel alloys. And so there's already quite a large market, but something like lithium and cobalt were really quite small markets only a couple of years ago. And already they have increased, I think, probably doubled in size over the past 5 years or so. And the projections are that they would double, triple, or even more in size over the coming decades. So those are markets where we're going from a relatively small market to suddenly a much larger market. And we're going to need to find lots more supply. In most cases, the supply or the resources are there. So lithium, for example, there's a lot of lithium in South America, also in Australia. Nickel, as I think we just heard, and we'll probably talk about quite a lot more. Indonesia has increased its supply of nickel enormously in the last few years and is projected to do so even more so in the coming years. So the resources are out there, but nonetheless, it's a big challenge for the global mining industry to increase supply by a huge amount of some of these commodities.
So I guess there's a nickel rush as opposed to a gold rush, as you say, but it's been transformative. Now, we heard about Indonesia, and a lot of people listening to that story would think, okay, if you're a country that is lucky enough to have these critical minerals, the government announces it's going to ban the unprocessed form of those minerals, and lots of investment comes in and you get the downstream industry, which helps you perhaps avoid some of the issues that Jim was talking about earlier. Should we be encouraged by the Indonesian example?
I think the Indonesian example is a very impressive example of a government pursuing a policy here to encourage investment into its nickel industry and also to develop some more of the processing of the downstream and being successful. I also think it's a very rare, I'm hesitant to say unique, but it's a very rare example of a number of factors that Indonesia had in its favor. The number one being is today a vast share of the world's nickel supply, a significant share of the world's nickel reserves. But even when they started this policy direction nearly a decade ago. So Indonesia first actually banned exports of nickel ore in 2014, and they were a much smaller player in the global nickel market at that point, but they were still the key supplier of nickel ore to China and to the Chinese industry that was turning it into nickel pig iron, which then was an input into the Chinese stainless steel industry. And so when they did that, the Chinese stainless steel industry had little alternative but to come to Indonesia and build nickel pig iron plants there because there wasn't an alternative. So I think if we're talking about how countries can capture the most rents from these industries, Indonesia is a rare example because they have such a dominant position in a particular market. Botswana is a good example in diamonds. They also have a very large share of the global diamond market. And so that puts them in a very obviously puts them in a much stronger position, gives them much more leverage if they're negotiating with companies, countries to try and extract more rent from their natural resources industry.
And Jet, you also had said that perhaps there were quite a lot of attractions to going to Indonesia anyway, and even without the policy, you might have seen this kind of inward investment.
Yeah, absolutely. So they were really kind of pushing water downhill. The origin of this was the nickel pig iron industry, which is a kind of low-grade nickel that was used in stainless steel and built and rose up originally in China after about 2006, when nickel prices shot up a lot, and that made this process of making nickel pig iron economic. And at the time when Indonesia started this process of restricting exports, it was way cheaper to make nickel pig iron in Indonesia than it was in China, both because of the shipping costs, because you weren't having to ship lots and lots and lots of very low grade ore, but also because Indonesia is very rich in coal. Coal powered energy was very cheap. It's an energy intensive process. So the kind of costs we're talking about, it was costing about $6,000 to $8,000 a ton to make nickel pig iron in Indonesia versus $10,000 to $12,000 in China. So there's a really clear economic incentive behind it. And in fact, some of the Chinese companies that have invested now and built lots of, I think, say privately at least, that they might have done it anyway, even if the government hadn't banned exports. The other point I would make is, and it's a really interesting case study for lots of reasons, that there's been this really close partnership and alliance between the Indonesian government and China, and in particular a few Chinese companies. Prime among them, Tsingshan, which is the world's biggest nickel and stainless steel producer, and may be familiar to listeners because it was at the center of a huge short squeeze in the nickel market last year.
Those who avidly look at the short squeeze.
Those who avidly follow the metals markets. But even if not, it's a fascinating company. It's one of the great innovators of the global metals industry, and they really bet the house on Indonesia a number of years ago and have forged this very close partnership with the Indonesian government. And in exchange, the Indonesian government has really opened the doors to them, allowed them to make the investments and build the projects that they were building the way that they wanted to. So, you know, using Chinese workers, giving them tax breaks, all of these kind of things to really encourage them and to make it as cheap as possible for them to come and make those investments in a way that lots of other countries with nickel resources hadn't done. And so as a result, you've seen this kind of huge investment from China, principally, into Indonesia. And as a result, this massive boom in the Indonesian nickel industry.
Well, for those listening who woke up this morning not realizing they were going to be much better informed about nickel pig iron by the end of the day. going back, or thinking now about Africa, Jim, we have this quite encouraging example in Indonesia. We do have a palpable boom in materials that, as we've already mentioned, are present in large amounts in certain African countries. What's the prospect for African countries announcing that they're not going to export unprocessed versions of these materials? One of the reasons we were doing this story was at one of a recent Bloomberg conference in Morocco, the New Economy Gateway. We heard a Ghanaian minister say that they weren't going to export unprocessed lithium as they developed that industry. How feasible is that?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that the overall opportunity is pretty exciting for African countries. So we do see a boom ahead in a whole range of different metals and minerals. Jack mentioned some of them already. The earliest are around the battery minerals, but there are many others, including rare earths, that are found all over Africa in abundance. So there's a big opportunity here. Africa's been the most underexplored region in the world. So it's not only that we know there's a lot there already, but there's probably even more to be found as well. On top of that, I think there's a recent growing recognition that supply chains for some of these metals are fragile, but also quite concentrated. And so, of course, a lot of the processing gets done in China, but also in places that are far from, say, US markets. And so as the US tries to increase its capacity in electric vehicles, in batteries and things like that, there's a kind of a new sort of interest in figuring out how can Africa build out some of these supply chain themselves, which could help bring resilience, not just in the interests of African countries, but in the interests of others in the global market. So there's this kind of alignment of interest that is quite new and quite unique that we hope will work in the favor of African countries. As Jack rightly points out, there are challenges to this. It's not as simple as, oh, you just announce an export ban and everything will sort of follow suit. It's worth noting that even in Indonesia, they had to give away some pretty serious tax concessions to some of the mining companies to make this kind of work for them. And when they'd first tried this in around 2014, it wasn't a universal success. they did run into challenges. There wasn't enough smelting capacity. And actually, they lost a lot of their market share in bauxite production. The bauxite demand, some of it got driven to Africa, to Guinea. And the share of Indonesia's bauxite supply fell, and I don't think it's recovered since. So there's sort of cautionary tales here as well. But the ambition of governments like Ghana is to be applauded and to see if they can sort of seize the moment, right? You've got the increased bargaining power that some of these countries have. DRC, of course, is a great example of this, with a huge share of the world's cobalt supply in DRC. Combined with the rising demand for these metals, combined with the fact that there's interest from other actors, but it's a window of opportunity, and it's one that can close easily. So you may see headlines around this idea that is lithium the new oil? And I think we need to have a touch of realism to go with this, that lithium is not going to be the next oil for various reasons. The size of the market is a fraction of what oil is. It's the dominant battery technology of today, but it doesn't mean it remains to be the dominant battery technology of 2050, for example. And actually, if prices were high and sustained between now and 2050, the incentive for people to come up with alternative battery technologies would be even greater. So African countries need to see themselves in this global game where there's innovation happening at a very fast pace. And so while they might have some bargaining power, it's not a blank check. It's not a blank check to say we're going to ban exports and everything else will follow. You might actually inadvertently drive investment elsewhere, and it could backfire, as we've seen in some countries.
Well, and also, I mean, we're speaking in the week where the British government has had to extend enormous inducements to persuade Tata Industries to put their big battery factory in the UK, hundreds of millions of pounds, supposedly. We don't know the exact number. I mean, this is a very competitive market, and there's lots of subsidies flying around. There is a risk that you're just adding costs and adding reasons for companies not to go there.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, the first thing is to note that not every country that has an abundance of minerals has the processing supply chain. So a huge amount of iron ore comes out of Western Australia. They're the biggest iron ore producer in the world. They're not even in the top 25 of steel producers in the world. All of their iron ore from Western Australia goes to China, goes to the steel mills in China. Similarly, Chile is famous for being a successful copper producer, but more than half of Chile's copper is exported raw. And that proportion is actually rising rather than falling. And so it's not the case that to be a successful mineral-producing, affluent economy, that you have to go down the supply chain of the minerals that you have in abundance. Actually, a lot of the processing makes sense to take place closer to the markets, closer to the manufacturing centers, and so on. So this is not the recipe for success that is necessary, right? This is not the path that countries like Australia and Chile have followed. It doesn't mean it can't be successful, as the Indonesian case is starting to demonstrate, but nor is it necessary for success.
Both of you have spent a long time looking at this, and Jack, you've reported on many commodity booms and busts over the years. Does this feel different? I mean, either in terms of the incentives facing the big industries involved and the governments that are pushing for those climate targets, or in the sort of underlying conditions in Africa and other commodity producing countries?
I don't know. I think, you know, this time is different is obviously the most dangerous phrase to utter in finance and markets. No, I don't think so. I think, you know, it's obviously a fascinating moment and a very exciting one if you are in the batteries or the battery metals industry. But fundamentally, these are commodity markets, and they will and indeed are going through booms and busts. So, you know, Jim was talking about the different chemistries going into different types of batteries. And already we've seen in the last few years, as electric vehicles have grown and grown, and this has become a front page story that shifts in the battery chemical battery makeup in part in response to things like concerns about the concentration of supply of cobalt, say, from Congo, are making meaningful impacts. So, for example, the cobalt market at the moment is in a bit of a slump. The price of cobalt is at the lowest in quite a number of years, in spite of the fact that the market is growing very rapidly and demand is growing very rapidly. That's absolutely true. But nonetheless, the price is at a multi-year low. One of the reasons is a big increase in supply. Another reason is actually the chemistry of batteries has been changing. So car makers, particularly in China, are using lower cobalt batteries and batteries that have no cobalt at all in them. Lithium iron phosphate batteries are rising very quickly in popularity. So if you look at some of the forecasts for demand for cobalt in 2030, say, from last year to this year, those forecasts have been cut pretty substantially. So, for example, I was looking at earlier today at a company called Darton Commodities, which is one of the key forecasters on cobalt, and they've cut their demand from electric vehicles for cobalt in 2030 by about 20% as a result of that shift. So these markets can absolutely still go through booms and busts, and that does make it a competitive environment. And unless you're in a position like Indonesia in nickel or Botswana in diamonds, if you're not in that rare position of being a very dominant supplier of a market, it's much harder to have that negotiating leverage. It's not to say it's totally impossible. And I think one of the, there's a couple of interesting things of the current moment that I would just point out. One is, you know, a lot of processing goes where energy is cheap. It tends to be quite energy intensive. And so you have big metal processing industries in places like Scandinavia with hydroelectric power, Iceland with geothermal power, the Middle East with cheap natural gas. Increasingly now, as solar and wind become very cheap sources of power, possibly, and potentially you have hydrogen as well coming as a way of storing that renewable power at some point in the future, that can really democratize access to cheap power and make that availability of cheap electricity no longer such a stumbling block for countries that want to build processing industries. And the other, of course, is what's happening in global geopolitics, where suddenly the US and EU in particular are looking at the dominance of China in the processing of all of these metals and saying strategically that's not great for us, and willing to spend large amounts of taxpayer money to try and change that situation. As the example of the UK is showing, probably they want to change that situation by building capacity in their own countries rather than in Africa, say, but potentially there's a possibility there for some kind of joint venture where you see countries in Africa or South America or Asia or wherever it might be being able to get some kind of government funding from the US or Europe or other countries that want to try and diversify their battery supply chains.
One of the most evocative examples of some of these issues from back in history was the Calico Acts, when Britain actively banned Indian cotton from the British market in the 1720s to protect and help kickstart the British cotton industry, and I think set back the textile industry in India for hundreds of years. So I guess we would hope that what is different now is that industrial countries are not actively trying to thwart or openly trying to thwart the development of developing countries. Jack Farchi, Jim Cust, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Stephanomics. Next week, we'll have more, in fact, the last in the current series. In the meantime, you can get a lot more economic insight and news from the Bloomberg Terminal website or app. This episode was produced by Magnus Hendrickson, Yang Yang and Summer Sud. Special thanks to Claire Zhao, Annie Lee, Chandra Asmara, Norman Hassano, Jack Farchi and James Cust. And of course the brilliant Tom Lehrer for the elements you heard at the start. Molly Smith is the executive producer of Stephanomics, and the head of Bloomberg Podcast is Sage Bowman.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.